So tonight, we are going to kick off the next three classes. We're going to talk about the book of Job. I hope you came prepared to discuss and to talk, and because I think that if it's okay, we're going to try not just to read it, we're going to try to discuss it. We're going to try to consider our servant Job. And what all do we know about Job as a person? He was patient. That's almost the name that we equate with him, isn't it? The patience of Job. And how do we know in the book of James that patience comes about? Through much tribulation. Job must have prayed for patience. And if you're praying for patience, please let me know before I sit next to you, because I will put my lightning rod up. Because if you're praying for patience, you can expect much tribulation. I had to reword my prayers years ago and say, God, please give me patience. Don't make me earn it. Just give it to me. And
he was a very wealthy man, the highest esteemed friends, obviously with those around him, had much to be desired, and yet he worshiped God.
And he worshiped God, and he was righteous, faithful, and trusted God. Now, what made his wealth? What kind of car did he drive?
Mustang.
How many camels? That's the thing. Yeah, Mustang, that's good. How many camels? 3,000 camels? How many sheep? I think it's 7,000 sheep. How many kids? 10. 7 boys, 3 girls. You know, his quiver was full, wasn't it? Gene, how many kids you got? You still got some work to do to catch up with Job then, don't you?
Not
everybody. Do we consider ourselves men and women when you have kids and your quiver is full? Do you consider that wealth?
Yes, sir.
It's our treasure, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. And then grandkids, you know, I always like to say the word grandkids and look at Bill Holt's face. Because you say grandkids, I know the name running through his mind is Tabitha. And she makes him smile. She can probably make him smile on days when nothing else can. And I have a feeling a number of y'all relate to that with your grandkids. I don't have grandkids yet, but Caitlin and Zach have a little boy named Sullivan that I sure like him. And Solomon and Rayleigh and Mary Helen, we've got all these children in the faith and in our church family that bring joy, just seeing these babies, seeing these children. It can lift your whole day. That's wealth, isn't it? It's blessings, and it is blessing. Now, so we're also told in verse 1 of Job 1 that he was upright. What does that mean, to be righteous or upright? Right with God. I'm sorry.
That's what's right, what God wants it to, and those around him see that he's up there.
Gene?
Oh, that's what I was going to say. The people that knew him knew that he was honest, he was upright. He was someone to be depended on, could be depended on.
Do we identify with Job? It's okay, be honest. Do you, at this point, do you identify, do you feel blessed? Do you believe you are blessed? Do you believe that, and understand there can be, with some of this wealth that we're talking about, I don't know if I would feel blessed with 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, because somebody's got to clean up after them. But the reality is that sometimes you can almost feel there's a curse in having wealth and having blessings, because it can be a distraction from what's really important. And it doesn't appear to me that Job was distracted by his wealth, by his materials, by the blessings God gave him. Did y'all understand that?
I think he trusted his children too, but he took no chance of that. And because he was so righteous, he took opportunity when he thought they may have sinned to pray
Absolutely. You know, one of the things the end of verse 1 says, and one who feared God and shunned evil. Now, I don't believe there's anything new under the sun. I think the Bible has told us that. And yet he was able to balance life, even wealth, and continue to fear God and shun evil. I look at that as I believe Job was a man of no compromise. He didn't compromise himself. Didn't compromise his family. He was a caretaker of his family. His wealth, starting in verse 2, he had 7 sons, 3 daughters. I guess I ought to use some of these. The Hebrew word for Job is persecuted or repentant one. Greek and Latin are similar words. The book of Job, we don't know the author. We don't really know the time. Some people believe that because Moses was from near Uz, that perhaps he wrote it. We don't know. We believe it probably was written around 2000 BC. And here, starting in verse 2, animals showed wealth. And starting in verse 2, 7 sons, 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen. Don't forget the oxen. 500 female donkeys and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people in the East. He was renowned for his wealth. What does it mean? What's the significance? I'm asking this. Does anyone know the significance of the emphasis on the female donkeys?
They can reproduce.
Well, and his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. They took care of each other. Do you have a picture of the happy family? He actually had more kids than the Kingsleys.
One of the things about the book and the age of Job, I think the number of children and the fact that each had their own home tells you that he's not a young man. He doesn't have all these kiddos at home. He has some time.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to go down a little bit, and Job, actually, I want to emphasize the end of verse 5, that after the feast, Job would send and sanctify them. He would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all for his children, for his family. And Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did this regularly. You know, fathers, do you pray for your kids? I know from experience we do. So what happens in this story of Job? What's next? One day, Satan came among them. The sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? And he said, from going to and fro over the earth and from walking back and forth on it. We're also told that that's part of his M.O. in Peter, like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? You You built a hedge. He's only happy because you bless him. Now, and let me ask you something, too. Do you believe that God blesses us today? If we're obedient, he blesses us.
Sunshine.
Every day is a blessing. We're blessed because he gives us life. Matt?
Yes, but that's the part where it gets tricky is in the book we learn that that's not always the case. And sometimes you do what's right and good things don't necessarily happen.
We learn that it rains on the righteous and the unrighteous. We learn that even evil men can rise and have great wealth. It's temporary, but I mean we're kind of promised that. It'll fade, but you don't build your house on your wealth.
Back up a minute and explain to me who the sons of God are.
Well, the sons of God, where the term indicates that they were angels. They were fallen angels is the term. I may have that's part of how, since we're told in Ezekiel 37 that Satan or Lucifer was an angel, that's possibly how he had gotten amongst them to come present themselves to God. To me, it's interesting that they could be going to present themselves to God still after they fall. Bill, do you have a better answer?
No.
Okay. Just angels. Or looked upon the women, the daughters of men. Anyone else? Matthew? Matt, have you got an answer to that? Who were the sons of God? I may research that phrase more before Sunday and come back to that. Right.
It's a contextualized concept, but I think in this case, if you kind of combine it with texts like in Daniel and other places, this is the idea of like God bringing together his officers, his court, kind of like the same picture in Revelation, it's his council. And so then they're having this discussion about this, about who to go after.
Okay. Well, that's something I can research further and see if anybody wants to do that. We'll do that. Absolutely. So, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, blameless and upright, one who fears God and shuns evil? And Satan answered and said Does Job fear God for nothing? Basically, his question is, if you were to stop blessing him and giving him all this wealth and everything, I don't think that he would be with you anymore. And so and as Chip brought out a minute ago, Satan said, you put a hedge around him, remove the hedge. So the Lord said to Satan, verse 12, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out of the presence of the Lord. Now, God thought very highly of his servant Job, didn't he? Have you ever felt like you were suffering so much that God must think really highly of you? Because we're told he won't let us let more come on us than we're equipped to handle. Wes? Let me ask, as children of God in the faith and in his family and his heirs, are we guaranteed it's all going to be hunky-dory and we're going to have great wealth and privilege? And I find more evidence that we're guaranteed. Why do you look as though this fiery trial is some unusual thing? For if you have taken on the calling of Christ, are you not going to suffer as he has?
Paul was told by God that his grace was sufficient for him. Enough. When he was asked to have the thorn put in place and taken from his son.
Yeah. It. And again, these are real questions, and it's because I have to ponder my own self when I read this, and because I admire Job, and I think we should admire Job. But have you ever read this and thought this is unfair, that Job was done unfairly? And let me kind of bring the question home a little differently too. Have you ever undergone some suffering on your own part and blame God for it? I think of that cartoon. The guy hits his finger with the hammer while he's driving a nail. And usually the words that come out are not good words. Usually it's symbols in those cartoons because he's cursing. And all he did was hit his hand with his own hammer. He did it to himself, but my goodness.
The hammer did it.
Yeah, the hammer did it. That's right. Blame the inanimate object. But when we undergo suffering, there's times it shakes our faith up. When we lose a job, it can be faith-shaking, can it? When we lose a loved one, it can shake it. It can rock your world and break your heart, but it can shake your faith. It can make you ask questions. And I think part of what I'm getting at here is that it's okay to ask the questions. You won't find anywhere. Well, you will find later that God answers the questions, but. But God doesn't really rebuke him for asking the questions. That's part of a relationship. Daddy, can you tell me this? That's our relationship with our Father, to ask questions. The trick is, or the thing we have to be mindful of, is to do it respectfully and to be open to the answers and be looking for the answers, not just asking the questions to darken the waters. Norma, okay.
I think you're right in that, and if you look at the whole book, you see that Job does be very contrite at the end, and he thought it was unjust.
So verses 13 through 20, or through 19, he loses his children, his cattle, his possessions,
his wife's trust.
Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a great wind collapsed the house on top of them. They're all dead. He arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And in all of this, Job did not sin nor charge God. How is it worded in here? Charge God with wrong. There's a shooting in a high school. And the people in front of the cameras, as soon as the microphone's in front of their faces as they're walking out, are saying, "Why would God let this happen?"
It's the gun's fault.
Or it's the gun's fault. But as a society, we're very quick to charge God with wrong, to blame him for the maladies and for the violence and the things that happen. He let it happen. Even though, I mean, can you imagine? I can't imagine somebody walking in and telling me that my daughter's been killed, but it wouldn't be God's fault. He did not, I mean, lost everything, not just one child, lost all 10. I don't have a doubt that a righteous man loved his children. Chip?
I don't mean it harshly, but we're just mere humans. It's all part of a larger plan. You know what I'm saying? Just because we don't know why something happened this day doesn't mean that there's not something in that person's life that might have been a lot more tragic if they would have had to face. Does that make sense?
It does.
And neither did Job.
He didn't know. He was not privy to the conversations about him. He didn't know.
Don't you take that list that we had at the end of the Habakkuk, we could pretty much plot it to the same list. He does exactly what Habakkuk said he did.
You're right. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Hebrews, right now I'm drawing a blank, 11:6. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Faith doesn't blame God when wrong happens. And this is a good example here. Anna? Chapter 1 here. Any other points or comments? Bill. Oh, Wes.
What's interesting, chapter 19, the same chapter, he says, "For I know my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth." He also says in 7:8, "Behold, I cry out violence, and I am not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness upon my path." So Job's perspective is that God had actually walled him up, and he could not pass.
Very good point. Yes.
A couple of things that are interesting. In Ephesians, we read about this battle that's taking place between God and Satan. We're in the warfare. It says the weapons of our warfare are not physical weapons.
Not flesh and blood.
You have pictures in the book of Revelation of this war that's taking place between God and Satan. And yet, the battlefield is our lives.
You know, and that's part of the point I was trying to make too, and us being able to relate to Job, and to the fact that without faith it's impossible. Life is about pleasing God, and if we crash and burn just because something bad happens, and there goes our faith. We really never had faith if that happens, and we've got to have faith even through suffering. I mean, we're going to suffer. And it can't change. Our faith can't be negotiated by our suffering. It can be strengthened by it. You know, and one of the things I would love to see him see the words of hope that we'll see later by the end of the book. But, you know, as a man of faith that trusts God, I believe that even though the words aren't in here, that he had this attitude that I can't help but believe that since he continued to be faithful to God, that he knew it was gonna. There was a purpose for it, and he was gonna be okay. One way or another, he was gonna be okay. Now, was it horrible? Was he grieving? Yes. But he knew he was gonna get through the storm. You know, one of the interesting things in Psalm 23 to me is that, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. That's a dark, kind of a dark reference, the valley of the shadow of death. But when we're in that valley of the shadow of death, we've got to also be cognizant that it takes light to create shadows. It's not all darkness. And there has to be light. And we've got to be children of light and see the light in things. So, chapter 2, on to chapter 2. Once again, those sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where did you come from?" His answer is the same. "From doing what I do, Lord. I'm going to and fro about the earth, seeing whom I may devour. And again, have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on the earth, blameless, upright, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." And Satan answered and said, "Skin for skin, yes, all a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. So what did God do? He said, go ahead, make my day. Now, you know, one of the things, too, about suffering, if we can look at this when we're in those types of conflicts and in the midst of suffering, is to look for how God gets glory through it. You know, what's going to be the end of this story? Is it just going to be that I'm going to be miserable and die? Or is there going to be some life and something that changes for someone because of my suffering? There might be somebody watching me go through something that realizes, man, his faith in God got him through something I wouldn't have made it through. Have you ever thought about that when you're in the midst of it? When you're in the fire? Because, you know, we don't have a verse that says that was in Job's mind, but I can't help but wonder if someone of that great a faith, if his neighbors around him weren't witnessing him still having that eternal hope, even in the midst of all the suffering, even in hurting, he's still trusting God. He hadn't turned his back on God. I've heard too many, even brothers and sisters, and I wouldn't call it cursing God, but I've heard them questioning, you know, well, I just can't believe God's letting this happen. And they're blaming God for it. And it's like, well, if he is, you know, yeah, if he is, he's God. Who is the rose to argue with the master gardener when the master gardener takes the rose and crumbles it to smell its aroma? Can the rose complain about it? Carl, I know you've got a comment. So he strikes Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown on his head. You know, Kaylee shared a prayer request for her. She's got a problem with the tooth, and it reminded me of a year and a half ago when I had the worst pain I've ever experienced, and it was an abscess that was almost the size of a golf ball in my jaw and one of my bottom teeth. Worst pain I've ever had. And I can't imagine having boils from the soles of your feet to the top of your head if it was anything close to one boil or abscess in my mouth. I can't fathom it. I mean, that's torture. I mean, does anybody have, Wes, you're a medically minded person. Is there an explanation of what a boil might be, what we would compare it to today? I think of inverted hair follicles, too. Has anybody ever had an inverted hair follicle that gets a little infected, swells up, and it's very, very painful? Rising. It's a rising. But all over your body. Does anybody remember having chicken pox growing up or measles where you had sores all over your body? And chicken pox, they really weren't that sore until you scratched them off. But they had their own, they itched.
Everything, and we don't feel for a period of time, having experienced.
the pain and almost pain that makes you wish for death. You know, just end it. Yeah. It takes the pot shard and is scraping the wounds. Man. I am trying to drive the point home of try to consider the worst pain you've experienced, probably multiplied, and that's what Job had on him. I mean, and yet, it's the end of verse 10, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. That's significant, isn't it? So we're going to wind up tonight, but we're kind of going to look Sunday at what I like to call the great debate.
In the chapter 3, Job is recording his birth because of the misery he was in. In verse 25, he says, "For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me." What do you think he's talking about?
Well, the spoiler alert is we're going to talk about that more Sunday as we get into that. But I do hope that we're able to answer that. You know, it is interesting that he, one of his first responses, he doesn't curse God, he doesn't blame God, but he and one of the, I was sharing with Shane this morning, one of the neat things in this reading, when Anna and I read last night, we actually read the wrong psalm, and after I read we just looked at it wrong and read the wrong psalm, and I said, this one bugs me. I said, it doesn't fit. Sometimes it's amazed me in these readings how the psalm fits with these gory stories of atrocities that are committed by God's people, and yet the psalm seems to fit it. I mean, it's like, you know, boom, this happened, and then it's, you know, hey, don't let my enemies prevail over me and do this evil, you know. Well, last night we read the wrong one, and then when I found the right one, I went, ah, because here Job has suffered calamity. And what does he do? What's the psalm? And his mercy endures, Psalm 136, his mercy endures forever. He's just lost everything, and he is still, I can just see him walking down the road saying, his mercy endures forever. And man, I hope I can be that way when I'm suffering, that I can remember that his mercy endures forever, even in the midst of that. It is also interesting that, you know, we'll get into this too, one of his responses was to wonder if his children had brought this upon him by their actions. And I do believe that part of the answer to your question is this thing, he was constantly concerned about his children. We'll try to answer it on Sunday. Thank you for your comments. And
hey, Joel.
Yes.
One thing about this section that I think is an important thing to kind of grasp with suffering is there's a really bothersome question that should come out of these first couple of chapters, and it's, why do I serve God? And it's kind of reverse engineering what Satan is saying, but just in suffering, idol of my health, the idol
I know in times that I have been experiencing grief, just having people be with you in case, strengthen them. Not necessarily what they tried to say. Others? Okay.